The Tom Woods Show, episode 620.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
How about this? One of the best email marketers in the world happens to be a libertarian. It's Daniel Levis, and he's giving away a video and a PDF to help you increase your sales through email. Check him out through tomwoods.com/Daniel. Hey everybody, if you missed this week's webinar with Sarah Young, the mom of seven who became an expert affiliate marketer, there's going to be a replay available just through Sunday, March 20th, 2016 at tomwoods.com/Sarah. And by the way, my mother joined their coaching program. Check it out, tomwoods.com/Sarah. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. Let me start off actually by telling you what the next couple of episodes are going to be, because I had said that we'd talk to Karen Kotowski this week, and I've actually moved her to Monday, to episode 622. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about, let's just put it this way. It turns out that the IRS is about to become maybe 15 to 20% more evil than it is now if a new law actually takes effect, a new regulation. I don't know exactly what the right word is, but it's a rule that's been held at bay for about a year, but it's set to take effect in September 2016, and it's terrible, and we need to be aware of it to see if maybe there's anything we can do to stop it. So more detail on that in tomorrow's episode. But today, we're talking to Roger McCaffrey again. I talked to him in my bonus episode a number of episodes ago. I don't know if I remember, was it 616 actually, about the Catholic Church. But we're going to talk about politics today. And in particular, we want to say a little something about insurgent campaigns and political consultants. Political consultants in presidential campaigns earn a fortune. A fortune. If you had any idea what these people are being paid, you would never, ever again donate to any political candidate, if in fact that is something you're currently doing. And by and large, what the success of some of these insurgent campaigns has been showing is that these people are totally overpaid, that you can do the exact opposite of what these people say, and you still do really well, and you save the money. You don't have to pay these people. So when I say insurgent campaigns, I mean campaigns that are run against the establishment. And the sorts of campaigns that I might have in mind here don't necessarily have a lot in common in terms of what the candidates believe. So there's no question about it that Bernie Sanders, for example, is running an insurgent campaign. But so did Pat Buchanan. So is Donald Trump. So did Ralph Nader. So did Ron Paul. Now, you can see there's a little bit of overlap in a couple of their positions, but these are very different people. But they have in common they were running insurgent campaigns, and they were not doing what political consultants would tell them to do. So I want to talk about that. I think this is very interesting that one thing the Trump phenomenon could wind up doing is cutting the salaries of these people. That's what Roger and I have been talking about on the phone, is that the Trump success has come very much in spite of the fact, or perhaps because of the fact, that he's totally ignored the advice of these people. And I'm talking to Roger in particular. Roger is the president of Roman Catholic Books. He's been a direct mail expert for years. He worked for Pat Buchanan in the 1990s, and he's very plugged in. He knows everybody. His family started the Conservative Book Club and Arlington House Publishers. He's very plugged into all this, and he remembers. He's got stories from the insurgent Buchanan campaign where Pat was clearly not doing what consultants were telling him, and he wasn't really hiring a whole bunch of them. So I find this stuff fascinating, and I know you're going to enjoy our conversation. Roger, welcome back.
It's another thrill. Two thrills in a week.
I know it. I know it's crazy, but you're also a great guy to talk to about this whole phenomenon. All right, I want to ask you a devil's advocate question right off the bat. This is my best devil's advocate question I've got. It's easy to say, and we'll go into this in a minute, that everything that the political pundits have said about Trump turned out to be wrong. He's not going to run. Then he's not going to hit 20%. He's not going to hit 30. He's not going to hit 40. He's not going to hit 50. Or they've said he doesn't like St. John McCain, so he's going to be out because of that. He's going to be out because of this remark or that remark. Every single thing they said is wrong. Everything they said is wrong. So maybe this shows that they're all full of hot air. My devil's advocate question is this. I can see that point of view. But Trump is such an exception in so many ways. He's independently wealthy. He's extremely well-known. The American public got to know him. I got to know him growing up as a kid, and then he was on a very, very popular television show. And he's making politically incorrect statements. That's a very, very rare combination. You're not likely to come across another Trump. So even if they were dead wrong about this guy, there aren't that many Trumps coming down the pike. So, you know, can't we give them a mulligan?
Well, first of all, there's a difference between a pundit and a consultant, even though a political consultant strategist, they often become pundits, but there is a difference, although they're both usually stupid. But here's the thing. Trump will be copied for eons. So you're going to have Trump types. A lot of them are going to be synthetic Trumps, if you can fathom that or get your mind around that. But you will have Trump types from now on. We're in the 21st century. So, you know, it's the era of Trump more so than the era of Reagan, unfortunately. Although I like Trump in many ways, I'm not dissing Trump because I think he could easily win, and he speaks for me in most areas. So,
all right. Well, look, I don't want to get into a debate on Trump, but when you look at his specific proposals, a lot of them are not very good or not very well articulated, or he wants to make it easier to sue the media, or he wants to kill families of people overseas, or he wants to send ground troops against ISIS and whatever. And before you know it, all the reasons you got excited about him have all dissipated.
Right. Right. Well, you know, look, you know, there's room, isn't there, on the campaign trail for hyperbole?
So I guess that's what you want to call.
Listen, I mean, this is a democracy. All we have, Tom, since we're not Democrats, is one vote. So,
yeah, that's right. That's right.
No, what the heck?
That's right. All right. I want to get something of your perspective on this, having worked with Pat Buchanan, because everybody's comparing, you know, they're comparing Trump either to they really are basically comparing him to Buchanan, because they use the Samuel Francis analysis of the middle American radicals to explain the Trump constituency, and Pat was really appealing to that demographic.
Exactly. In fact, I had many a meal with Pat and Sam Francis, talking about middle American radicals. Although Sam used a slightly different term for a while there, but by the way, I worked for Pat, not with Pat. we were up close there in late 91 and 92, because I had done the publication, his first publication. I marketed it, and later when Grigorsky, his first editor, really Pat was the editor, let's be frank. But, you know, Frank Grigorsky, Newt Gingrich's former chief of staff, was actually the first editor. He quit eventually because Pat got too strong for him. Frank liked a different brand of conservatism. So I then became the editor and so forth. And we spent, you know, plenty of time there. And I pointed out to him, I take credit for this, that my strength was direct mail. I could see that when we marketed the newsletter that this was a huge success, the first publication from the right. And I said, this has presidential implications, because you raised money through the mail in 1992 and by phone. And
Well, when was Pat writing that newsletter? When did that start?
Well, we started in 89, 90.
Okay, so well before the 92 election.
Yeah, and by the way, it would have become a magazine had he decided not to run for president. But again, the thing was so powerful. I mean, the results, the returns were so powerful that you could see this had a presidential meaning. Pat and Bill Buckley were the two big names on the right, period. Reagan, of course, the biggest, but he had retired by then. So,
and Pat had worked for Reagan.
Yeah, Pat was his chief of communications. Pat was with Reagan at Reykjavik, you know, when Reagan walked out on Gorbachev. Pat was there in the limo writing the Reagan airport speech as they drove to the airport to go back home. I mean, they were just, Pat was with them all the time there for a couple of years.
I remember reading it was Pat who ran into the Oval Office and told him that the Space Shuttle Challenger had exploded.
Yeah,
and
that's
generally you were not supposed to run right into the Oval Office, but Reagan thought in this case it was appropriate.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, Pat did. So Pat, you know, Pat was the first guy to ignore the professional political class and get away with it for a while in 1992.
All right, yeah, I want to talk about specifically how he did that, but let's back up for a minute. Did you have any role in or any conversations with him about a decision to run for president in 92?
Yeah, but that was his. I did not persuade him. My role was to say, I think you can raise, you know, anywhere from $5 to $30 million. In other words, from anywhere from 10 in today's dollars, 10 to 50 million bucks. Yeah, that I said, sure. But I didn't even know Pat had made the decision until, in fact, first of all, he didn't make the decision until roughly November of 91. And he didn't tell anyone. Bay, who ran his campaign, was still in California. I mean, she had to move. So you could see that he really wasn't sure until November. But in January of 91, I remember talking to him about Bush's approval ratings, which were 91%.
Yeah, immediately after the liberation of Kuwait, it was 91%, and he seemed invincible.
Exactly. And then I said to Pat, which, of course, he would have said to me, there's no place for him to go but down.
That's a good point.
And you know, I mean, that's so clear. Plus— you know, Pat knows politics better than anybody, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Certainly as well. And he knew that 91% was heading for 50% at best. And he also knew Bush. He had a fix on Bush. And I think he felt, he never said this to me. I didn't, you know, ever debrief Pat, but I think he felt that Bush would tack to the center. That was his comfort zone. And Pat felt that he could outflank him and maybe beat him. He ran to beat him. He did not, like Trump, by the way. Trump ran to win from day one. He wasn't pumping his brand or anything. He figured he could win. And so did Pat. And he almost pulled something off in 1996. And as you know, he got 38% against the sitting president in New Hampshire in 92.
Yeah, it was really, really high. So he was, but yet I would think almost everybody would have been thinking that Pat is just running to make a point. He's representing frustrated conservatives. You're saying that's not the case?
Definitely not. And I remember the press conference the night before he announced in New Hampshire. That was an amazing press. It was not a press conference. It was a backgrounder for the press. There were no mics allowed, but the room was just crammed with reporters of note. And, you know, I mean, it was a mob scene, and Pat was explaining to them on background, i.e. off the record, why he was running. And one of them asked him the very question you just asked. And he said, and he explained, look, I see a seam, quote unquote, I see a seam in Bush's numbers, and I see a seam through which I can win. He absolutely ran to win, and I'm sure he figured, I'll go in 96 if I do well in 92 and don't win.
Did you work with him only in 92, work for him only in 92?
Yeah, 92. That, in fact, I left March 1st, so after New Hampshire, which essentially was the end of the campaign, although, you know, He got votes in many other states. I did December and January and February were my months. And that was amazing.
So you wrote direct mail that was sent out to a great many people basically saying the sitting U.S. president is a bum. You did that?
Well, I did a couple pieces, but nobody wrote for Pat until he got a machine going, which really was 1996. So but here's an interesting thing, Tom, about the whole consultant class. And Pat always kept his distance from the professional right. He was friendly with them, but he always kept his distance. And, you know, sure enough, they wanted in on his campaign. I was not a member in good standing of the Beltway Right.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. Well, I was down there for 3 years. I worked in Washington as a member in good standing, but common sense prevailed, and I moved back to New York. But because of my father and my own role, and my father was Conservative Book Club, Arlington House Publishers. He was the only successful book publisher ever on the right until Phillips pumped millions into Regnery. I had standing, but anyway, I represented I could do what the professionals could do, but I wasn't a consultant with a capital C.
Now, why did they want in on it? Is it partly for they saw dollar signs? Or was it also
yes.
because they just couldn't imagine something major going on that they weren't a part of?
Well, both. It's both. They said there was huge money to be made, and because his direct mail was so good. And his future was bright also. And plus, they live to just have meetings and strategize and recreate the great Reagan victory of 1980. You know, that's what they're all about. But anyway, so the point is regarding his direct mail, his announcement letter, which was a phenomenal success in the mail, he gave it to me, and it was an announcement. I said, this should be a letter. First of all, this should be your announcement letter. We should mail, this will mail a million, we'll mail a million pieces of this. Well, all the professionals met at his house. I was there, of course. And I mean, that was just laughable. And afterwards, they all went home, and somehow or other, word got back to Pat that they didn't really like his announcement letter and counseled him sagely that it wouldn't work. I said, keep every word of this. It was a brilliant letter. A brilliant, brilliant letter, Tom. I can send it to you. And, it's one for the books, and Trump would be well to look at it. But I added one paragraph to that letter. I cannot claim. I wish I could claim to have written it. But my role was to say they're full of it. Ignore them. They're wrong. This thing's going to work. And man, did it work. I mean, Bay, who worked on the Reagan campaign, said that
that's his sister, just for everybody to know.
Sorry, Bay Buchanan ran Pat's campaign, but she also worked on Reagan's in 1980. She said these results are better than the Reagan results. Reagan, of course, won on the landslide in 1980. So what I'm saying is consultants are, as we know, they're full of baloney. You could see that Trump has a handle on consultants, and he doesn't like to throw his money away any more than Bay did in that little campaign, which grew much bigger than we expected.
But on the other hand, Roger, in 1996, Pat, to some degree, signed on Frank Luntz.
I know. Well, he signed him on in 92.
Oh.
Actually, he signed him on in 92. I remember seeing... But that 2 weeks before Luntz, before I saw him show up in the office, I remember sitting down to dinner at the Hunan Lion at Tyson's Corner, and Bay was there. I think Sam Francis was there, Pat Shelley, me. There was one other good friend that you and I know who was there too. I don't know if he's so humble, he might not want to be mentioned.
He might not want to be mentioned, but I know who you're talking about.
And we were talking about pollsters, and I said, and everybody agreed, including Pat, what do we need pollsters for? Well, 2 weeks later, we had one, and it was pretty much agreed that they were not needed. So what I think happened, I never said to Bay, why did you hire Frank Luntz, who was a nobody then, by the way? And she explained to me, he's not interested in a political career. He just loves this for him. It's just an intellectual feast or something.
Oh my gosh. This is like saying Saddam was responsible for 9/11. It's so wrong.
it just was. He's an academic. He's a teacher. I didn't know.
He was an adjunct professor at the time. An adjunct professor is somebody who works at a car wash most of the time and teaches a class,
Well, he looked – when I met him – I didn't even meet him, by the way. I walked past him. He looked like he had just been in a car wash.
I don't even know what that means, but that's great.
Well, it was not an elegant sight. Let me put it that way.
No, I know what you mean.
And you know, Bay would not have overpaid him. But the idea of hiring a pollster when we had powerful direct mail results and different kinds of mailing lists and even different regions of the country measured, was, to me, was a kind of a waste, really quite a waste. And they actually had two pollsters in 1992. But however, they had the money for it. See, the money came flooding in. It broke all records. And that just made the professional political class on the right in Washington salivate all the more. And they did everything they could to undermine me and anybody else who was authentic. You know, but
so things were much different then than they are now. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the more things change, anyway, no, they'll be around forever. But what Trump has proven is they're not needed at 20,000 a month. You know, so what Trump's campaign has done, among much else, is cut the price of the political consultant in half in future campaigns. And that's all to the good.
All right. I definitely want to pursue this. Let's pause, though, just for a quick message. Hey, everybody. One of the best email marketers in the world also happens to be a libertarian. It's Daniel Levis. And I asked him flat out, if people want to increase their sales, is improving their email marketing the best way? And if so, what's so special about email?
For the vast majority of businesses, yes. If your market uses email, you can increase your sales with email marketing. And dramatically so, when you know how to use it. No other communication medium is more personal, more direct, and more economical. And you know, social media is all the rage these days, but you know what? No other communications medium has more reach than email. There are more email accounts than Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and all of the other social media platform accounts combined. Not only that, studies prove that people are 4.5 times more likely to buy through email. Plus, when you build an opt-in email list, you own that asset. You control it. Not true with any of these other types of media. You're not a landowner. You're a serf, tilling the soil on somebody else's land, and they can boot you off on a moment's notice.
Get an unfair advantage over your competitors when you check out Daniel's free resources, his video and PDF, at tomwoods.com/Daniel, before he takes them down. Now, is it the case that there's no role at all for political consultants? I mean, most political consultants, or maybe all, I know exactly more or less what they're going to say. I know what their outlook is. I know the kinds of things that the candidate is supposed to say, things he's supposed to avoid, how he's supposed to apologize for alleged gaffes. They've got it all written out in a playbook. And that, to me, seems like I could throw that all in the garbage and not be any the worse for it. But is there any role for these people at all?
Yeah, and you hit it on the head with that point. Where there is no role, if you have a candidate with brains, is for the strategist consultant, you know, who tells the candidate what to say to maximize his vote. Now, if you have half a brain, you can figure that out as a candidate. And Trump, I hope, has killed that species of consultant. As I say, though, Tom, he's at least cut their monthly fee in half, if not 80%. In the future, other candidates are going to get the idea that they might be able to do without a strategist consultant who loses half the time anyway. You know, Michael Murphy, the guy out in L.A., who used to be in Washington, the guys with the real money and the real success stories go out to L.A. and become screenwriters or something. I don't know if Luntz is out there. But, you know, they're a waste of money. They're a waste of money. But you do need a guy who can handle social media. You still need a direct mail guy because you can still make money in mail. You got to use physical mailings. So but if you see their name in the paper, you fire them. That's my attitude. And you know, Tom, that was the attitude of the old pros, the Vic Golds, who was on, he goes back to Barry Goldwater. Vic is still around, although he's not a consultant and never was a consultant. Bill Clark, who was Reagan, who was the other guy who Bill had permission to go into Reagan's office anytime he wanted without announcing himself. and, you know, Lynn Nofziger and people like that, when they saw their colleagues' names in the paper in campaigns, their attitude was they need to be gone. I suppose a campaign manager is exempted from that, but you don't want it. You want the candidate in the paper, not as strategist and not as speechwriter. And those people need to make as little footprint as possible.
And plus, there's also the practical fact: nobody cares what the deputy guy in charge of such and such has to say about anything anyway. So,
well, except reporters care because they need to get
a quote from somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, and they need to do it as conveniently as possible.
But the voters aren't. The voters don't care. The voters care what Ron Paul thinks. They don't care what Jesse Benton thinks. They don't care what any of these people think. They want. They care what the candidate thinks.
Right.
So I definitely, anybody who has a mouth problem, yeah, that person would be gone. You know, I sometimes sit and think about not a lot, but when I'm talking to Lou on the phone, we sometimes trade advice about we unsolicited advice to candidates. You know, he could have said this, could have said that. Wouldn't that have been hilarious? And like, for example, Trump, it just seems like even though he has amused and entertained me, he's got a lot of missed opportunities. I mean, like when that list of 100 so-called foreign policy experts came out against him, and they brought that up in the debate. Oh my gosh, did I have a line for him? You know, that what he should have been ready with. That these people, right? These are the people. You know, where they basically owe us $1 trillion after all the money we've blown following their advice. I hope they keep writing. I hope they write a letter every single week till November. I'll use it as confetti at the inaugural ball. You know, use that.
Yeah. Oh no, I agree. And he could borrow a lot of Pat's Buchanan's lines from 92 and 96 especially.
And see, Pat was brilliant at that. I mean, Trump is good at the sledgehammer, you know, hey, you're kind of fat kind of remark. But Pat had these clever, absolutely cut you to the quick kind of lines.
Yes. And he wrote them for candidates too. I mean, that's what he did for Nixon. And that's what he did. He did it for Agnew. You know, they put him on Agnew's plane with Vic Gold, by the way, in the 1992 campaign, which was a very hot campaign, even though Nixon won it in a landslide. Pat was writing these lines, and a smart candidate looks at 10 of them and picks two of them. And I guess Trump probably has now a writer on staff, but he doesn't use them much.
No, he doesn't. I mean, and his speeches are very stream of consciousness, meandering sorts of things. But yet it connects with people because I think they feel like anybody who gives me a polished speech is probably going to screw me.
Yeah.
It seems to be their attitude.
And how wrong is that?
Yeah, I mean, so far it seems to be running at 100% accurate.
Yeah.
So I have no control group though that I can't look at people who speak badly and get elected because there really aren't that many of them. They're all teleprompter, super polished sorts of people. They're not all exciting speakers, but they're all extremely proper. Mike Dukakis could not speak very excitingly, or neither could George H.W. Bush, but they could stick to a script.
Right. Well, what I would do, should we get into Trump and what consultants he should use, or are we?
No, sure, yeah. I mean, I'm curious to know what you think he needs.
Well, what he does need a writer, and for a few lines a week, and I don't want to see the guy's name in the paper or he's gone. And you saw him with Roger Stone, who's got, by the way, he's highly credentialed, but I think Trump wanted to be the only guy whose name was in the paper.
Yeah.
Okay, he needs that. What he desperately needs is he needs IT guys very badly, because this election, if it's close, which it probably will be, I'm assuming Trump is the nominee, it's going to go down to, you know, 10 or 20 precincts, or it could, in the United States. And you need somebody to know who knows those precincts cold. So those are the guys he needs. And remember, Google and all these creeps out on the West Coast are helping Hillary. They're helping her now. They're going to be helping her in the future. And they have the upper hand. The Republican Party is not just way behind on IT stuff, and they were wrongly credited in 2008 with being ahead. They're not ahead on anything, by the way. But you know, that's what we're up against. If you're rooting, let's say, if you're rooting against Hillary, those are the consultants he really needs. And you know, you won't see their names in the paper, but those guys are desperately needed, or this campaign will not prevail.
Now, I myself, as I say, I mean, there are things that Trump has said that I'm glad he said. But then as soon as he says them, he makes me cringe with the next thing that he says. So my part of my life where I endorse candidates or I get involved in campaigns, that chapter of my life is closed almost certainly forever. But I still am interested to follow it. So, you know, which is why I enjoy conversations like this. I'm interested to follow it. But let's predict. Let's get you, just because you have observed this stuff for a while, and you worked closely with Pat and so on for a long time, and I mean, anybody who even just gets to talk to Pat for a long time, that's a tremendous advantage. I want to know if he really is the nominee up against Hillary Clinton. There is a part of me that feels like she crushes him in a Goldwater style landslide, LBJ style landslide, because she has all the Democratic Party interest groups in lockstep, and because he has said at least one thing that enrages a lot of people. There's another part of me that feels like American elections are not decided in the faculty lounges of U.S. law schools. They're decided by regular, ordinary Americans, a lot of whom apparently feel like what he's saying really resonates with them. And he is actually making inroads into the black community and even among Hispanics, people say, oh, why would Hispanics vote for Trump? What possible reason would Hispanics who are settled here and established have for wanting a flood of more Hispanics to come in? They don't necessarily want that. So of course it makes sense for them to vote for Trump, and there are plenty of them who are going to do that. So which one of those two analyses do you think is closer to the truth?
Well, he's going to get tons of. I don't understand your. How's this for a candidate? I don't understand your question. I think he's going to get a lot of minority votes, meaning he'll get 10% of the black, 10 to 12% of the black vote.
I think maybe. He'll get higher. I think he'll get higher.
Well, okay, 15 to 20. That would be, if he does that, he's going to win the election. And I think he'll probably get a quarter, not more than a quarter of the Hispanic vote. So if that answers your question, that's my take on Trump, because he's going to be by the time this thing ends, six, seven months from now, the press will have done its work. The other thing is, who's he going to pick as his running mate? That's very important.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it seems like. It would not surprise me at all. It would not surprise me at all if he picked a basically establishment person. I would be shocked if he picked somebody outside the establishment.
Yeah, I think you're right. But how do we define?
Because in other words, once he gets the nomination, then I think he feels like he's enough part of the system that he can tone himself down a little bit.
Right. Well. To illustrate that point, I remember asking Pat Buchanan in 96, this is one that didn't make it to the Tim Stanley book, like a lot of things didn't make it. But that's the book on the Buchanan campaigns. And it's, you know, it's worth having. If you're a Pat fan, you want to read it, but it's not definitive. There's a lot missing. And one thing is, I said to Pat, who would you have picked as your run? You know, because he had beaten Dole in New Hampshire. And he had every chance to win the nomination if things had clicked and if he had more money in South Carolina. But who would you have picked as your running mate? He said, probably somebody like Kemp. You got to unite the party.
Gosh. Well, see, there's Pat's political mind, basically. You got to unite the party.
Yeah. And I think and if Pat would do such a thing, such a terrible thing.
Well, you do
if you want to win, and after all, that's what Trump wants to do. he might have to go establishment, but it's got to be somebody that he hasn't called a pipsqueak or a jerk.
No, it's going to be hard to find.
Where the hell are you going to find that? That's what I
– And that nominee is going to be faced with a barrage of questions everywhere he goes. Hey, did you hear what your running mate said today? Did you – you know, you're on the top of the ticket. How do you feel about all the names he's calling everybody? It's going to be a full-time job just to handle all those questions.
You're right. But I mean, are we going to get into names or do you not want to do that?
Because I am so pro names, I can't even begin to say. So go ahead.
Well, if I were in Trump's shoes, I would consider, I'm just again trying to put myself in his shoes, Huckabee, Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama. I'm not making value judgments, Tom. I'm just saying.
Yeah, as a political, you're right. My listeners are smart enough to know what you're doing, so don't worry.
And Steve King, the congressman from Iowa.
Oh, jeez.
Well, you know, I mean, look.
I understand why. I'm just saying.
You know, because you cannot go, if you go outside the box, if you go too inside the box, you're going to get a guy who's going to spend his entire 3 months explaining why Trump really didn't mean to sound as radical as he sounded on such and such. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
you cannot get the governor of Maryland as your running mate or something and then expect him to be able to handle trick questions. So you got to pick somebody who's on your team and yet who has establishment credentials. Such is my reading of it. I really don't know who he's going to pick. There's always Terry Branstad, governor of Iowa.
Oh, no. He's – oh, jeez. Oh, this is getting worse every minute that we talk. We got to switch – well, let's switch back. Let's talk about Pat Buchanan again. I can't take current events anymore. I want to ask you this. I've heard this theory about Alan Keyes that my understanding is that Alan Keyes and Bill Kristol were college roommates. They've known each other a long time.
And that's accurate. That's totally accurate.
All right. And that Keyes was polling way, way in the basement in 96. I mean, he was just not even registering. But he was taking a crucial few percent that would have gone to Buchanan if Keyes hadn't been in the race. There was no point in Keyes staying in the race unless you think to yourself, well, let's see, he's friends with Bill Kristol. Bill Kristol would die a million deaths before he'd allow Pat Buchanan to become president. He's in there entirely to thwart Buchanan.
Yeah. Plus, Keyes has never hurt for
ego, attention seeking. Yeah. What are you looking for here?
Yeah. Let's put it that way. There's no self esteem problem there.
That's right.
And so yeah, I'm sure they encouraged Keyes to. In fact, Keyes cost Pat Iowa in '96.
You think that's the case?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's that, you know, Pat, listen, if Pat had won the nomination in 96, he'd have beaten Clinton because Perot could not have run.
Oh, but wouldn't they have hit Pat over and over again with racism and anti-Semitism and over, all the stuff that we all predict is going to happen?
Yeah.
That's toxic stuff.
It is, but they're doing it to Trump minus the anti-Semitism bit.
But the thing is, the difference is that after 20 more tiresome years of this, I think people finally have the guts to stand up and say, none of these terms mean anything to us because 99.9% of the time they're being used unjustly and because we don't even know what these words really mean anyway. So forget it.
Right. Well, there's a lot to that. I do remember saying to Pat in probably it was 95, you know, if you get close the next time, if you win New Hampshire, there's going to be a huge press conference. Every leader of the party is going to be there and they're going to condemn you. And he thought for about 3 seconds and he said, that's exactly what I want.
That is such a great answer.
So, you know, you can, there is such a thing as jujitsu in politics too. And now whether that kind of thing gets you elected president, that's up, you know, that's debatable. But Trump clearly is proving that you can handle a certain amount of crescendo from the question is how loud is this crescendo going to get over the next 6 months from
right.
Trump's point of view, you know?
Yeah, and it will morally intimidate people into not voting for him because we, you know, that all right-thinking people don't vote for racists and whatever, whatever. So, I just cannot get out of my head the idea of a Buchanan-Kemp ticket.
Yes.
Because in that case, I would have been more interested in seeing a debate between the two guys on the ticket than I would have been between the Republican and the Democrat. I want to see Pat and Kemp go at each other.
Which they did. They did it on Larry King on CNN and roughly in 93, 94. They actually had a debate right there with Larry King in the middle of it, so to speak.
Oh, how about that? I would not want to debate Pat, even if I knew that I was 1,000% in the right and I had all the facts on my side. I still wouldn't want to debate Pat.
Great. Yeah. Well, it was not a good debate in the sense that Kemp was totally obnoxious. And by the way, I don't think Pat would have picked Kemp. He said somebody like Kemp, because as with George Bush in 1988, and I know somebody who was deliberating with Bush 41 as a candidate, a lot of people did not like Kemp. And he was, of course, on the short list for Bush 41. But Bush 41 didn't like him. And there was no way he was going to be picked. And I don't think Pat would have picked Kemp, but he would have selected somebody like Kemp. And there were certainly enough guys like that.
All right. I think we'll leave it there. I don't know what to link to on the show notes page for today. TomWoods.com/620. I don't know what to link to. Maybe there's some Buchanan thing we can link to. I don't know. We'll dig something up, something that's interesting. We'll put it up there. And I just enjoyed having a freewheeling discussion with Roger McCaffrey. And if we record it, even better. You know, historians 200 years from now can tune in and listen, get some insights about what was going on in early 21st century America. Well, thanks, Roger, for your time. We'll have to do this again soon.
Anytime, Tom. A lot of fun.
All right. It's March 17th, 2016, as I talk to you right now. And you have until March 21st to save dough if you are interested in starting a website or a blog. Bluehost is having a special sale this week. That's why I told you to wait. Don't start your website. Wait. Wait till the week of the 14th. Save the money. So that's still going. So if you want to do that, you want to get cracking on it pretty quickly. And remember, I give you a whole bunch of free goodies and tutorials and publicity for your site. And that's all over at TomWoods.com/publicity. Okay, the evil IRS is our subject for tomorrow. Don't miss that. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.